Welcome to Teaming Up Conversations, the podcast. I'm your host, Simon Vetter. I believe that one of the most satisfying and rewarding moments in life is belonging to a trusted team and achieving something unique together. Thank you for joining our dialogue, how to build, lead, and be part of an inspired team and community. Who doesn't want to be and feel well? Our topic today is about the practice and science of well-being. What is it? How do we measure it? And what are effective practices to ensure well-being? My guest today is Bev Schumacher, an expert on leadership, emotional intelligence, team dynamics, and group facilitation. She holds a master's degree in social work from the University of Georgia. As a licensed psychotherapist, leadership development specialist, and with a deep understanding of the human dynamics, her passion is to help leaders and teams to do and be well. She believes that individuals and teams are inherently creative and resourceful, and that it is essential to help them view their challenges not in isolation, but in a context of their surroundings. Please enjoy the Teaming Up episode with my professional colleague and dear friend, Bev Schumacher. Bev, I'm super excited for our interview today. We're going to talk about well-being. So let me start with a very simple question. How are you doing?
Well, thank you, Simon. I'm doing well. It's a great question to ask.
Talking about doing well, we talk about well-being. Yeah. What does well mean?
Yes, it's a great question because, you know, well-being is a term that gets bandied about a lot. And depending on who you ask, you might get different definitions. You know, the definition that I typically will use is that well-being is the ability to feel good and function effectively as we navigate the inevitable highs and lows of life.
So feel good and function well.
Function effectively, yep.
Can you elaborate what does that mean for you in your present moment?
Well, it means looking at the different levers of well-being. And of course, I have, you know, I use a model for well-being that's important to me that I've learned that I'll share shortly. But it means looking at myself in terms of physical issues, looking at myself emotionally, mentally, spiritually, you know, how am I doing across the board? And that changes. It's something that doesn't stay the same. It changes. It's a lot of times it's dependent on the content and things that happen in the environment, but it really is an overall sense of functioning well.
What I love about this, it's a very simple concept on the surface. Yes, there's so much depth to it. And it's something that is part of our life. It comes, it's as you said, and it changes over time, but it's something that comes with us, like this concept of happiness or this concept of well-being. So I really want to kind of take those layers apart and really understand the concept and the framework of well-being. Can you give us a useful framework?
Yes, and I want to just add a little historical context to this, because the whole notion of well-being is actually a relatively new concept. Martin Seligman, who is a professor of psychology, and in 1998 was the head of the American Psychological Association, made a presentation, and he said basically, you know, psychology pretty much focuses on reducing suffering, which is certainly a valued goal, but what it doesn't look at is what constitutes thriving. So he essentially invented the whole positive psychology movement and said, let's continue to reduce suffering, but let's also look at what helps an individual flourish. And he developed a model that's called the PERMA model. And it is a model that originally had five components. One of his research associates and students actually added a sixth component to it. But it's an acronym that looks at what are the six fundamental components of well-being. And P stands for positive emotions, E stands for engagement, R stands for relationships, M stands for meaning, A stands for accomplishment, and H stands for health. So each of those are building blocks, and there are techniques and tools to increase your level of well-being under each of those.
Let's stop here for a moment and repeat those six areas.
Yes.
Start positive.
Positive emotions.
E for engagement.
Engagement.
R
for relationships.
M
for meaning. A for accomplishment. And H for health.
Very good.
And they all can be measured independently. He also developed a survey called the PERMA Well-Being Survey. So they can be measured independently. So it's a very nice model. You know, the reason why we use models, and I'm sure you use a lot of models in your work, is because they help us understand things a little bit better. And as an executive coach in the last couple of years, what I noticed was a tremendous increase in the leaders whom I coach talking about their own personal well-being and also being concerned about the well-being of their employees. So I made it a point to really get to know and continue to get to know as much about well-being as possible. I completed a certification in enhancing well-being. So it's been important for me to dive deep so I can be helpful to the clients whom I coach.
You make an important notion about the well-being of a leader. And I have this, and I think a colleague of ours, Scott Eblen, did a presentation. He used a map with the weather of the U.S. Mm-hmm. And he said, leaders control the weather.
Mm-hmm.
If I'm a leader and I show up excited, people feel that. If I show up, I'm frustrated. If I show up overwhelmed, if I show up not having enough sleep, people feel that.
Sure.
So going back to your framework, I love the framework. And before we go into different levels, curious, can you tell a bit more about your fascination and your passion about well-being?
Well, you know, as I mentioned, it's been really important for me as an individual to provide the most value to my coaching clients as possible. Now, historically, Simon, I am trained as a clinical social worker, and social workers tend to have a very holistic view of health and function, you know, functioning. So I've always had a very holistic view of what it takes to function well, to feel good and function well. And I think because I've needed to just have more tools in my toolbox to help my leaders impact positively their own well-being and the well-being of others in their organization, that's been my fascination. So it really builds on a long history of being interested in the well-being and welfare of others.
There are three levels that you distinguish: the me level individually, the we level, more like a team environment, and then the us, the organizational well-being. Let's start with the me level. What are the key well-being factors to be considered?
Well, it's interesting because what you do is you use this model, this PERMA model, in all of those levels. The me, we, and us is a way to look at well-being kind of at the 50,000-foot view. So the me level is what are individuals doing to enhance their own well-being? So it's a way to what they choose to do to care for their well-being. And of course, that can be measured by the PERMA survey. The we level is looking at it as a group or a team. So what behaviors are important for team members to exhibit to support the collective well-being of the group or team? And then the us level takes it to, you know, really the largest, you know, 50,000-foot view, which is organizationally, what is the organization doing to support the social, emotional, and mental and physical health of their employees? What are they doing to promote that?
Starting on the individual perspective, what is the impact of high level of well-being?
Well, from an individual perspective, there's lots of research to support that people have fewer or less depressed or less anxious. They are more productive in the workplace. There are studies that show people are 125% less likely to burn out. People are 30% less likely to leave if you look at it in an organizational context. So there's tremendous research to support the benefits of well-being. It also leads to longer life, which sounds like a pretty intense claim to make. But for example, George Valiant at Harvard in 1938 started a longitudinal study that is still going on around adult development. And one of the things that continues to come out of that is that relationships, social connections are the primary factor in a long and happy life. So there are lots of benefits of an enhanced well-being.
When you coach a leader on individual well-being, can you maybe give an example how a person is overwhelmed or stressed or has too much going on or wants to improve health or level of engagement or working on relationships? Can you give us an example or an approach how you help that person on a holistic perspective to enhance that well-being?
Sure. The first thing that we need to do is to get a baseline of their well-being. And the PERMA survey, well-being survey, is a self-report survey, and it helps us to get a baseline of this person's well-being in all of those six factors of well-being that we mentioned. So, and again, it is at a point in time, because if you give it in a month or so, it may change depending on what's happening, but at least it gives us a baseline. So based on that baseline, we then go over the PERMA well-being survey, and I ask a couple of really high-level questions. What's working well, you know, based on the survey, what's really working well in your life? What challenges, what's not working so well? What challenges are you, you know, do you have in your life? What have you learned from looking at your data here about well-being? And what do you think you need to adjust? So I get their input, their response to the survey. And of course, at some point, you know, we'll go back and forth and I'll add some specific tools based on the area of focus. They usually pick one or two areas of focus. And the survey report is really pretty specific about how you're doing in terms of overall well-being. Are you thriving? Are you just getting by? And also which area you're doing better in at that point in time, which area you need a little work in. So that's the best way to start. And then that leads to a lot of sessions around things that they can do to enhance their well-being in the areas that they want to focus on.
Do you have an example how you help the person make some significant changes?
I've done this with many folks. I have a division leader in a global health organization, really was probably working, I'm thinking 70 hours a week. I mean, this is in the last couple of years because of all of the stressors of the pandemic and the staffing issues. And we did a PERMA survey, and it was really clear that there were some key areas that he needed some work on. So one of the things that we did was to help him set boundaries. You know, one of the things that happens in this pandemic work environment is that if people are working virtually, which he was, it's really hard to set boundaries between the beginning of the day and the end of the workday. So we worked on helping him establish some rituals at the beginning of the day, work starts, and some rituals at the end of the day to say work ends. So we really worked on helping him establish some boundaries. The other thing is that this was literally a former marathon runner who had totally been neglecting his health because of the stress of work, and it was taking a toll. So what we did was we started with tiny habits. We started incrementally, and he started doing things like taking a walk at lunch every day with his wife, who happened to be working home too. And he worked up to taking longer walks, and he worked up to then, you know, joining a running club. So we worked on various small incremental changes he could make to his health. That made a huge difference for him. Also, he was able to lower the number of hours he worked to about 50, which was a huge improvement from 70 to 75 hours of work. And we're still, you know, I'm still working with him. So there's still improvement to be made, but he's made a lot of progress in that area.
Talk about those habits, those tiny habits, those behaviors.
Yes. Yes.
What are some examples of your own personal routines that you have established in your life that is positively correlated with your well-being? Give me some examples.
Absolutely. Absolutely. When I get up in the morning, Simon, I get up at about 7 o'clock and I have my shoes, my dog walking shoes right by the bed. And I get up and I have two dogs and probably about 7:15, I get up, see those shoes. Okay, it's time to walk the dog. And I've established that behavior. You know, you have kind of the trigger, the anchor, and then you have the behavior and then you have the little celebration. So every morning I walk my dog. And when I come back, the reward for doing that is I go get my Starbucks latte. And that's my reward. Now, I've also started to stack habits. So when I get back and after I walk the dogs, get my Starbucks reward, I also do a couple of 2-minute planks from a physical standpoint. And so I know that when I'm done with my coffee, it's time to do planks. So that's an example of a habit that I have and that I've worked pretty hard on. And I've been doing it now for over 2 years.
Wonderful. Excellent. Any other simple behaviors that you can recommend to some of the audiences that we know we should be doing, but we are not doing it?
Yeah, absolutely. And it depends which area of that PERMA model they want to focus on. So, for example, if people want to focus on positive emotions, the thing that the research points to as the most powerful way to change your positive emotions, you know, add positive emotions, is gratitude practices. So people can do that in many ways. Some people journal that. Some people, you know, when my head hits the pillow at night, I say 3 things that I'm grateful for. So just a simple practice of daily gratitude, however you want to do that, can have a big effect on your well-being. If you're working on relationship issues, make time for your family. If you're working on health issues and you have trouble sleeping, then look at your sleep hygiene. You know, get rid of those devices a couple hours before work. There are many guided meditations that can calm your nervous system for 15 minutes before you go to bed. You also might wear one of those Aura rings. You know, I'm not supporting, you know, or advertising for Aura rings, but there's a lot of technology that kind of helps you determine the quality of sleep. You can look at your diet. Also, there are so many apps that allow you to focus on 1 or 2 or 3 areas of well-being. There's mindfulness apps. So there are a lot of ways that you can track that.
What about meaning? Support meaning. Some people, they struggle to have significance in their life.
I think that's a great question because meaning is the one that's a little bit kind of hard to grab onto. Like, how do I, you know, where do I get a purpose? But meaning is about purpose. And one of the easy ways to do it is to think about what you do during the course of a day. And what's the bigger meaning of that? You know, it's the old story, which I'm sure you've heard, Simon. It's the old story of if a bricklayer thinks that they're just laying bricks every day, okay, that's their job. But if they know that what they're doing is building a cathedral, then there's a much greater sense of meaning because they are part of something bigger. So some people get their meaning through social institutions like churches, political institutions sometimes provide some meaning, community institutions, but it's looking at your activities and saying, what is the larger meaning? Also look at your values, get clear on what your values are and say, am I living my values? Am I living my values? So meaning is a part of being about something bigger than yourself. I mean, I love my work, but I also do my work for a larger reason because I feel like I add value. I feel like it helps people. And that's the meaning that I derive from my work. So try to take what you do and what's the bigger reason that you do it? What's the meaning of what you do?
Let's also focus on accomplishment. It's one of the components. Any specific simple routines?
You know, accomplishment, you know, is all about accomplishing goals, setting goals. You know, I like for people to, obviously, goal setting is a big part of what people need to do in terms of what do you want to accomplish and what's most important to you. One of the simple things that you can do is you can ask yourself every day, what is one thing I learned today? And you can also form a little tiny habit of saying, what is one thing I can do today to learn part of a new skill? So you can ask yourself, what did you learn today? You can look at what you did that day that was really, you're really proud of, you felt really good about. You can also work on how can you set goals that have meaning to you. And of course, there's a lot of techniques for goal setting that people can work on.
A friend of mine had this exercise called AM, PM questions. He said in the morning, write down three things you want to accomplish today.
Yep.
And in the evening, write down three things you have accomplished.
It's great. It's a way of looking back and kind of taking in the good and giving yourself credit for what you have accomplished, because sometimes it's easy to lose track of that because we get involved in so much, and it's really easy to lose track of what we really did accomplish that day.
One of the concepts I apply when I meet someone, I always ask myself, what is one thing I can learn from that person?
Mm-hmm. That's great.
And I approach this conversation differently than me proving to them who I am. So it's a little bit of mindset shift. And that's one of the practices I apply.
That's right. That's great.
Let's move to the we level, to the team level.
Absolutely.
What are some important considerations when we talk about the well-being of a team?
Yeah, and especially in this environment that we're in and the work environment that people have been going through. This is about team and the group level. One of the things that leaders have really found out is that how can, you know, there are so many important things that need to happen for groups to feel connected and to feel safe. And of course, the research that MIT has done, the research that Google has done on Project Aristotle, talk about a good team, a well-functioning team, has a high degree of psychological safety. Everybody has everybody's back. They can feel open and vulnerable in an appropriate way, and they feel connected. So one of the things that's important for leaders to do is to, especially in this environment, be more intentional about having people do things to connect, do team activities online, teach people about the skills involved in connecting. It's important to offer opportunities for people to talk about what's going on, what's important to them. For example, you can do things like assign check-in buddies for people to check in with, you know, with their check-in buddy every so often just to see how they were doing. So they're not just talking about work all the time, but they're also talking about their life overall and what's important to them. You know, it's important to know how to actively engage team members in this remote environment, because a lot of people are still remote. I mean, it's becoming a hybrid work environment, but you still have a lot of remote workers. There are all kinds of things that you can do. You know, one is encouraging people to have their camera on, because it's a little hard to connect with a name on a screen. The other thing, and a lot of teams do a great job at this, be a little creative. You know, do kind of brunch and learn, do trivia games, do bingo, do people have done things, silly things like intro pets. You know, there's all kinds of creative things you can do to help people.
Remember, we had a meeting in our group, Alliance for Leadership Excellence, where we did a connection exercise where everybody brought their pets.
That's right.
And talked about them.
That's right.
Which
that's right.
I don't have a pet, but it was so great to see everybody's pets and what it meant for them.
Yeah, that's right. And you know, in this environment that we've been in, you do get a more of a sense of who people are in terms of their environment. So there are all kinds of things. As a leader, the question becomes, how can you model being empathetic? How can you model being vulnerable? And how can you help your leaders and your managers learn how to be attentive and empathetic to what's happening in the environment? The other thing that's important with teams is, you know, one of the things when I first started at AT&T as a sales leader, my manager said, you know, Beth, people will never forget how you were with them when times were tough. And I never forgot that. And the leaders who create the most effective teams are leaders who are really attuned to the personal things that impact people's work life. Doesn't mean they don't hold people accountable, but it means they care, they're empathetic, they work with them to try to do what they need to do to juggle. So that's really important, I think.
You mentioned vulnerability. How do I appropriately show vulnerability?
Well, I think appropriate vulnerability, you know, you certainly don't want to talk about the fight that you had with your spouse that morning. That's not appropriate vulnerability. I actually had a leader a long time ago who did those kind of things, and it made everybody nervous and made everybody clam up. But I've also had leaders, and I've been a leader, and I know the leaders I work with are like this, where if they're struggling, they'll tell people. They'll admit when they're struggling with things. They'll admit when they make a mistake. They'll acknowledge that it's been tough. You know, this has been a tough time. So they will be honest and not just have a corporate mask and, you know, say everything's okay when it clearly is not okay. But they will be open and honest about how they're feeling too. And again, it needs to be appropriate. It needs to be something that is not talking about your deepest, darkest secrets, but is really an authentic expression of when you are struggling, when you do make a mistake, when, you know, just to acknowledge that times have been tough.
I have a team assessment to measure the well-being of a team. And it's very simple. I ask two questions. 1 to 10, how well do we work together as a team? Mm-hmm. And then how well do we need to be working together to accomplish our objectives, to feel positive, to excite our clients and to perform at the high level. Mm-hmm. And it's a very simple team exercise.
Sure.
Do you recommend, or do you have any other measures or to evaluate the well-being of a team?
Yes, the PERMA Workplace Survey is a wonderful way to evaluate how a team is doing, because you get both individual results, everybody gets their own individual results, but it's then aggregated in a report that shows where are we on all these PERMA levers, where are we as a team, what are we doing well, because we want to certainly focus on the things that are going well for us as a team, what are we not doing so well, what do we need to adjust and do differently, and what do we need to keep doing. So that's a wonderful workplace survey, which I've actually used with quite a number of teams, and it's been very effective because out of that comes a roadmap for what the team needs to work on.
An example of a team, what they did exceptionally well, and what was the biggest struggle they had? Can you think of it?
Yeah, I have a leadership team whom I've worked with actually for, you know, a relatively short period of time, but we did the PERMA Workplace Wellbeing Survey with them. And they are an executive leadership team, and they are managed, you know, they're the head, the CEO, is somebody who is very, very analytical and very scientific and very task focused and just basically brilliant in terms of the technical aspects of their job. However, one thing that came out very clear in the PERMA Workplace Survey was that the relationship piece was really struggling. So one of the things that we did with the team, I worked with the leader in terms of how this leader could develop his ability to be emotionally intelligent, extend empathy, listening, and what kinds of things specifically the team needed to do so people could get to know each other. So we had a series of team building sessions. They were virtual, but people would get to know each other. We had activities where people gave each other feedback on what they found valuable and what they could do to make the team even better. So even simple things like that were very, very transformational for this team, such that they really started talking to each other instead of just talking at the leader and the level of connection. And we did a follow-up PERMA survey, and their relationship level, they really improved in that dimension, which was very, very gratifying.
The last 2 years, a lot of work, teamwork went virtual. And it has a totally different dynamics.
Yes.
It's easy for people behind their screen. What is to help teams connect and work well together in a virtual environment?
Well, it is really important, as much as you can make this happen as a leader, is to have people have their camera on. I know in certain organizations, that's a little dicey, and some organizations say, look, you can't force anybody to have their camera on, but I think that's helpful for people to have their camera on. The other is that as you're working in the virtual environment, you have to find a way to engage people. And that engagement has to do with being able to facilitate a meeting, for example, where you can do subgroups, you can do polls, you can have people put things in the chat room, so that what's happening is that everybody is engaged in the meeting in various ways. Because it's too easy in virtual meetings for one person to drone on and everybody else is checking their email. That's a skill set, and that's a skill set that whomever is leading that team at that time needs to know how to set up the meeting to maximize the level of engagement. And there are some very specific ways to do that, as I mentioned.
Now, if you're a team member, it's not your meeting, you participate, you're a little bit more reserved, more thoughtful, not as outgoing and expressive. And you also experience other people taking over, jumping in,
sure,
dominating conversations. What can I do as this more introvert, reserved person to change the dynamic? Is there anything I can do?
Well, it depends on what your kind of role is. You can, if you're just an individual in the team, you can suggest that the team take a style survey. You know, it can be DISC, it can be Myers-Briggs, there's all kinds of different style surveys, such that everybody learn more about the pluses and minuses of their style and learn to appreciate other styles. So, you know, it is a question of understanding that everybody is different. Everybody sees the world different. Everybody makes decisions a little differently. Everybody communicates differently. So helping people to appreciate different styles. And if you're not in a position to make that happen, if you're just a member of the team, certainly suggest it. But otherwise, just appreciate, try to be more curious and less judgmental of people. If you need to learn to speak up a little bit, there are lots of ways that you can learn to speak up a little bit. But try to appreciate what you bring to the table. Try to appreciate what the other person brings to a table. With some of my teams, I recommend reading, looking at a TED Talk called The Power of the Introvert. And also Susan Cain has written wonderful books on really, how can an introvert be in a world where everybody talks a lot?
What recommendation do you have? A team member, an important team member, and the leader of the team dominates the meeting all the time and talks more than half and doesn't listen and engage?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that depends on what the dynamics of the team are. If the team is such that people have group norms, have established team norms and team guidelines, and maybe one of those guidelines is, don't dominate the conversation, give everybody a chance to speak up. Establishing team norms and team guidelines is really, really important. If the team, because you can always point to that, if the team hasn't done that, if there's a level of psychological safety so that people can speak up, it's really helpful for people to say, can we do a timeout a little bit? Because I'm aware that there are a lot of people that I haven't heard from. And a couple of us, it's great what you say, but we need to hear from everybody. But I think first and foremost, as a team, they really need to establish team norms, which include some of those behavioral norms as kind of a touchstone for how they work together.
A lot of great tips. Thank you. Let's move to the organizational level, the us level. How has that been addressed historically?
Well, it's interesting. Historically, a lot of organizations have wellness programs. You're probably very familiar with a number of wellness programs, which is great. Typically, what they involve is, they'll provide a fitness center, or maybe they'll do flu shots once a year. They're probably going to add COVID shots to that program now. They also have an EAP program where they source that out. So that's good when businesses have things like that. Well-being has really risen on the corporate agenda because of the impact of the pandemic. It's interesting. Oracle did a study and said that 78% of people said that the pandemic had a negative impact on their work life. And 58% of the people that they surveyed across industries said that the pandemic had a negative impact on their family life, work life and family life, that kind of balance. So that agenda of well-being has really risen pretty high in organizations. So it really is a cultural commitment. The top level managers need to understand, commit to, model, and communicate what does well-being mean? And oftentimes leaders of organizations work, of course, in concert with HR leaders in the organization, but also there are also external companies who specialize in helping organizations set up well-being programs, because that's a pretty big effort, and monitor those well-being efforts. So it's really become a greatly expanded area of focus. And some organizations are re-looking at their corporate values and saying, are we including well-being as a value, and how are we actualizing well-being in the environment?
Do you have any good resources on that topic around organizational or even team well-being?
Say what you mean about resources, Simon, just so I understand your question.
Books or podcasts or things I can look up. Are there any good ways to learn more about that?
There's a tremendous number of articles and research on well-being. There is also a lot of podcasts on well-being. In fact, there's a podcast called Being Well that's by Dr. Rick Hansen. It's a great podcast. There's also a podcast by Barry Kaufman saying Making Positive Psychology Work and Positive Psychology at Work. So there are a lot of podcasts. You basically go to the search engine in a podcast and look at well-being at work, or well-being, and you'll see a lot of podcasts coming up. In terms of research articles, you know, again, Michelle McQuaid's Well-Being Lab, you can go to their website, and it's the Well-Being Lab, and they're very, very generous with the research that they have done and the tools that they recommend that are research-based tools. So you can click on that website and find a tremendous amount of information on well-being. Also, positivepsychology.com is an excellent website, which has just a tremendous amount of practical tools for how to focus on those components of positive psychology. So, you know, the resources, there's a tremendous number of resources available. And Google, of course, is your friend, because, you know, Google will help you get. And also, there are a lot of apps. There are a lot of well-being apps. You know, there's Calm. I have a well-being app called Mood Candy, which I love, which is out of the Mayo Clinic. Dr. Amit Sood does that one. UCLA Mindfulness app is fantastic if you're interested in learning about mindfulness and meditation. There are all kinds of health, you know, fitness apps that you can do to monitor your fitness. So the resources are pretty much endless. I think part of what's important is not try to boil the ocean. But you can take the PERMA well-being survey by going to michellemcquaid.com. You can take it for free, and you do your PERMA well-being survey. You'll get a report back, and it will show you which areas you're doing well in, which areas you might want to focus on, and then it'll also point you to a number of resources that are helpful for what area you decide to work on at that point in time.
I have a challenging question, and I struggle with that myself, and a lot of people do. Based on the numbers you said, 78% feel negatively impacted on their personal life because of the pandemic. You listed a lot of resources. So there's awareness that, yes, I have to do something. Mm-hmm. There's also a great supply of tools. Now, how do we get people to change the mindset and turn that into things, habits and behavior change?
Mm-hmm. You know, Simon, I really believe that the pandemic, the last 2 years, especially the 2020, forced people, because the activity level had dropped so much, it forced people to go inside and get a little bit more in touch with, you know, gosh, things are not fabulous. I'm anxious about what's going to happen with work. You know, all these things kind of boiled to the forefront when before, with everybody's just, you know, our activity-driven society, it just was under the surface. But you take away some of that activity, you raise the uncertainty in the environment. So what happens is that people are recognizing more and more that they are suffering in certain areas, that they are in distress, that they are more anxious, that they may be worried about the future, maybe a little depressed. So I think the awareness has risen. You know, one of the wonderful things about the pandemic, if you can actually say that, is that it has raised people's level of awareness of their anxiety, maybe their uncertainty, maybe things weren't working quite as well in their life as they thought. So I think awareness is always the key to change. And if people are in enough distress and want to change things, then people will find the resources to do it. I always think it's better to have a partner, have a group, you know, have a, you know, that's why in my well-being groups, when I work with teams on well-being, I always assign a buddy, you know, kind of an accountability partner. So I think people really are find that there are ways, you know, that they are in distress in certain areas and that there are ways that they can work on that. I certainly love James Clear's book called Atomic Habits, and there's BJ Fogg book on habits. There are a lot of books on habits because it talks about the importance of the incremental nature, you know, take little baby steps, you know, don't try to, you know, run 70 miles the first week when you haven't been running forever. But both of those books are fantastic. And there's many other books on habit forming, which sounds kind of bad, but habit formation.
I look back 2 years ago and I remember the first 3 months of the pandemic and everything kind of slowed down. And I know people said, you know, actually, it's good for us to decelerate.
That's right.
And it made us force to slow down, to take a step back, to use some self-reflection. Yes, there was a lot of uncertainty and ambiguous future and a little bit fear, but it had forced us. Now, 2 years afterwards, we're back in the race, going as fast as possible.
That's right. You're exactly right about that, Simon. And this is such an activity. This is such a do culture, isn't it? It's not a be culture. It's not a quiet culture. It's a get out there and do stuff. So you have to be more intentional and deliberate. And the best way to do that, I mean, go to that michellemcquaid.com, take that PERMA well-being survey, you know, every month and check in with how you're doing. And, oh, okay, I'm doing great in this area. Now, what do I need to do? What little teeny thing can I do to enhance my well-being? Because, you know, nobody's going to knock on your door and do it for you.
Right. And I, for me, that importance, you said deliberate, intentional, make time for introspection, make time to sit back and look at my life from a broader perspective and really challenge myself with some questions.
That's right.
And I know I want to do more of that.
That's right. And I have every week on my calendar, I have a cup of tea time. And my cup of tea time is when I go sit out in the deck if it's warm enough or find in my library, which I really love. And I literally sit there with my cup of tea for about an hour and a half. And that's my introspection time. What's working well? How are things going? How do I feel? What am I doing that's working well? What am I learning? What do I need to do differently? What do I need to adjust? And just let stuff bubble up. With no phone, no distractions.
Do you do that in your mind? You close your eyes? Do you write things down? Can you give me more prescriptive things how you do that? I love this.
Sure. What I do first, Simon, is I start with a 10-minute just breath. I always start with a 10-minute breath meditation because I have a pretty active mind and a pretty active life. So I need to find a way to kind of ease into that more introspective mindset. So I do a 10-minute breath meditation, and then I just think about the areas of my life. I just let bubble up, you know, how are things going? I ask myself, how are things going? I always have a pad of paper and a pencil. Sometimes I write things down. Sometimes I don't write things down, but I have it there just in case. And when I leave, when I'm about 5 minutes, you know, into my full time, when I'm about done, is I just kind of think, okay, what's one thing that I'm going to take from this that's going to be valuable for me, that's going to be helpful? And sometimes it's a little thing that I need to do. Sometimes it's a little thing that I need to add to my activities that I do every day. Sometimes it's just simply an awareness.
In the last few weeks, what are some things that bubbled up? Some of the conclusions and the things you implemented?
Yeah, the things that have bubbled up lately have in the last couple of weeks, I'm not doing as well in terms of the sleep component of my health and also the nutrition component. Now, I probably I'm very well versed in nutrition, but I've been eating a little bit emotionally. You know, I've been a little distressed about, kind of overwhelmed by all the activity and work that I've got right now and some of the plans that I'm making. It's been a little overwhelming. So I've noticed that my diet has kind of turned to the, you know, to the dark side, as it were. It's not as good as it was. So the other thing is that I'm not using good sleep hygiene. I'm reading my phone kind of shortly before bed. You know, I'm just veering off into doing things that I know I shouldn't do, and they're having an impact. I'm not sleeping as well. So for me, what I've done is I've done two things around sleep. One is I 2 hours before sleep, no technology. The second thing is I take this, it's a magnesium supplement, about an hour before. The other thing I'm doing is that at night, it's hard for me to fall asleep. So I'm doing a 15-minute, what's called yoga nidra meditation, which you can find on YouTube. And it basically calms your nervous system. So that's kind of the things that have bubbled up, you know, around health issues for me. And then there are a couple of things that I'm doing as a result of that.
I need some help. For the last 6 months, my goal is to put any devices aside an hour before bed. And I have failed miserably the last 6 months.
Yeah.
You as my coach, how can I change that? How can I change that habit?
Yeah. I want to ask you a question first, though. What are you looking at those hours? Like, what are you doing with your phone?
I look at the phone, at the calendar. I got different apps. I look at sport. I look yesterday, a Sunday newspaper in Switzerland. I read some articles. So there's always something I look at different apps. Yeah.
The first recommendation that I would make for you to consider is consider keeping it in another room. Set an alarm on your phone for whenever you go to bed, about an hour. I would recommend 2 hours if you can, but if an hour starts small, you know, maybe even start with 15 minutes instead of an hour. So you're not quite, you know, you don't get too anxious about it, but maybe start with little periods of time, set an alarm, and then take your phone and put it in another room. You will be uncomfortable. You will be anxious, but just have the feeling and it will pass. And also find a way to reward yourself for doing that habit. Even if it's only 15 minutes before you sleep and you put it in another room, find something to reward yourself.
Thank you. Thank you.
Absolutely.
I need an extra push, another approach to break that.
Yeah.
And sometimes I do, once in a while, I do some meditation. So I have the phone with me because all the things that are on the phone.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And, you know, we're all pretty addicted to our devices. And the one thing that happens when we try to wean ourselves a little bit, especially with around, you know, before bedtime sleep hygiene, is that when you do that, you become a little uncomfortable. It's not comfortable to kind of get away from that, but you have to just be with the discomfort, put it in another room, start small, maybe 5 minutes, 10 minutes before you go to bed, put it in another room, figure out a reward that you can have, maybe, you know, read 2 pages of a wonderful book that you have, you know, whatever, call a friend, whatever, you know, whatever works for you in terms of a reward, you know, have a cup of chamomile tea or something.
Yeah, replacing a bad habit with a good habit. So I do two things. I have a good book next to my bed,
yeah.
Paulo Coelho. I love his reading. And then also I have a journal. So I write down 3 things I have been grateful that day.
Absolutely.
And that really kind of shifts my mindset and calms me down more.
That's right. So that's wonderful. Just make it difficult to grab your phone. That's why at home, when I have chocolate around, I always put it on the highest shelf in the kitchen, because if I make it difficult, it allows my neocortex to come online and think, do I really need to do this? So make it difficult to access your phone at night. That'll help.
You had an advice for people, and that advice has been posted on everybody's screensaver, what would it say? What would be your advice on everybody's screensaver?
If I had to say one thing and one thing only, Simon, I would say gratitude practices. There's such strong research that supports doing daily gratitude in terms of enhancing your overall level of well-being that it's pretty hard to deny. So it's easy to do. So if I only could pick one thing, I would put do your gratitude practices daily.
Okay. If you can add two more things, what else would you add?
I would say be self-compassionate. It is important to be kind to yourself because it's a tough environment right now. Making changes in terms of your well-being habits can be challenging. So be self-compassionate. Care for yourself. Treat yourself just the way you would treat your best friend. And the third thing I would put on there would be less judgment, more curiosity.
Thank you. Very powerful advice. We'll put some resources in the show notes, but give me again the one or two resources that you recommended to take that self-well-being assessment.
Yes, I would recommend going to Michelle McQuaid, MCQUAIDE, michellemcquaid.com, and you can take the PERMA well-being survey for free and get your report for free. You know, you can always Google well-being, and there is a tremendous amount of research and literature on well-being. The other thing is you might go to your app store and Google well-being apps, so you can see the variety of well-being apps that are out there. But I think it's important to get that baseline assessment of how are you doing in those components of well-being so you know where to focus and you can do a more concentrated search on those areas to get tools. Also, positivepsychology.com has a tremendous number of valuable practical resources.
Excellent. Lots of good advice and tips. Thank you. If we want to find more about the work you have done, how do we find you?
If you will go to my website, which is brightstarleadership.com, I am there. And so you can see, in fact, I'm just about to add a blog post on well-being, and we'll continue to do that on my website and probably post it on LinkedIn soon.
I will definitely check that out. Beth, thank you so much for this rich conversation and this wonderful tips. A lot of the things you said, we kind of know that stuff and we don't do it. So it's really about incorporating those good habits into our lives. Anything else before we end up our chat? Any other last notions for the audience to know?
Start small when you make any changes. Just start small and be kind to yourself. You know, the journey of 1,000 miles starts with one small step.
Well said. Beth, thank you very much. I'm very grateful and we'll stay in touch.
Great. Thank you so much, Simon. I really enjoyed it.
I'm Simon Vetter and you have been listening to Teaming Up. To never miss an episode, you can subscribe on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast. Also, please refer Teaming Up to your friends, colleagues, and coworkers. It will make me happy when more people can benefit from valuable content. Thank you for listening.